Please take your Bible this morning and open to James chapter 4. James chapter 4. We're going to be looking this morning at verses 13 through 17. And this is a passage that I have preached before, but not here. I remember very specifically preaching from this same text 6 years ago. It was a New Year's Eve message. I sometimes like to preach a different message right at New Year's because with the calendars flipping over to a new year, there's just thoughts of change and thoughts of what's to come. And oftentimes, New Year's is a time when we start to set plans for what we're going to do in the coming year. So I thought that this would make a good passage to review as the new year began. And I went back to that message that I had preached 6 years ago, and I drew out a statement, a little paragraph I had written in that message. And I want you to listen to it, and I want you to see if there's anything mildly prophetic in these words, okay? This is the message I preached 6 years ago. This is the statement. Many of you will hang a 2020 calendar this week. All the months of 2020 will be laid out with blanks to be filled in with meetings and appointments and lists of things to do. But who can tell what the year will hold? There will be many unplanned detours and unexpected trips to the hospital. By the end of next year, there will be plenty of events scratched out of my planner. No one can truly know what will take place in 2020. That was preached in December of 2019. Who knew that we would suddenly be introduced to a lot of new phrases like social distancing and working remotely and sheltering in place? 2020 was one of those years that just shattered our illusion of having any kind of plan at all. And if we did have plans for 2020, they all got thrown out, pretty much. I know all of you remember just how strange that year was. You know, that's a good lesson for us, though. It's not just in 2020, but all the time. Our plans are written in pencil. They are not that which we can guarantee or count upon. You can't bank upon tomorrow. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't plan, of course. We should plan. I think we ought to plan if we're to be wise. Even Jesus taught that a man who goes to build a tower should at least count the cost before he begins to build. So planning is not something that we should discard, but we should plan with a warning in mind, understanding that we should be careful to avoid the kind of arrogance that thinks we can control our own destiny, that we call the shots, that we can take our life by the horns. This kind of arrogance manifests itself in presumption about the future. Here's what I'm going to do. Again, this is another point, much like New Year's, where we begin to make plans. Some of you who are students this week are making plans for the summer, for things that you want to do, or places you want to go, or see people you want to see. And that's fine to make plans, but we ought to hold them with an open hand, knowing that not everything we plan is going to come to pass. We're not in control. God is. So let's not be so foolish and so presumptuous as to think that we control our own destiny. Our plans could change in an instant, in the twinkling of an eye. So let me give you this admonition this morning. Do not boast about the future, but submit all your plans to the Lord. Do not boast in the future, but submit all your plans to the Lord. Such that, yes, we can make plans, but we can't boast about the future, and we certainly should say, Lord, whatever you decide. Now, we're looking here at James chapter 4, verses 13 through 17. James has been dealing with the topic of humility in this chapter. He's mentioned it in verse 6, he's mentioned it again in verse 10. And he says, what we need is a humble heart before the Lord. And then he gives two examples of arrogance. One of them we looked at last week, the arrogant man who speaks down on others, verses 11 and 12. That's one expression of arrogance, to prop yourself up and to put others down. But now he talks about the arrogance of someone who thinks that they can presume upon the future, who thinks that they can boast in the future. Here's what I'm going to do. Here's what I'm going to become. But that kind of arrogance is not the humility that God requires. So don't boast in the future. Submit all your plans to the Lord. There are three reminders that flow out of our text this morning, and I want to follow them as we unpack this passage. Three reminders. The first one is this. You are not in charge. You are not in charge. That's just a good reminder for us. Now, that may already be pretty obvious. I mean, you can't change the weather. You can maybe even hardly keep things together. But sometimes we operate with this illusion of control. There was a study done in 1975 by a woman named Ellen Langer. She entitled the study simply, "The Illusion of Control." And it was an experiment. They had people in different controlled environments. But what they found was the more a person was directly involved with a task, the more they presumed they had control over it. So a couple of examples. For instance, if a person was allowed to pick their own Powerball number instead of being assigned one at random, they had more confidence in the fact that things would turn out well for them. Or people who were able to roll the dice themselves versus having someone roll it for them had a greater confidence that things were going to turn out in their favor. So it's almost like anything we touch, we feel like, you know what, I have some level of control over it. But it's an illusion. It's an illusion because being able to pick your own number or roll your own dice doesn't give you any better chances. But it's that illusion of control, and we all operate with that. We think that we have more control of our lives. We're more in charge than we really are. But ultimately, it's God who is sovereign over all things. Look at James chapter 4, start verse 13. It says, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit, and yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes." So in these verses, the first thing that we notice is the attitude of the arrogant. The attitude of the arrogant here in verse 13. Now, verse 13 begins with the statement, "Come now." Come now. It's almost like an invitation. James is saying, I want you to consider the way that you're talking. I want you to think about what it is that you're saying when you talk like this. Come now. It's an invitation. And by the way, this is not talking, I don't think, about a specific case. I don't think James is identifying, you know, one person with whom this is a problem. It's more like, come now, I want you to consider this kind of attitude that each one of us is in danger of adopting. Come now, you who say, whoever it is that might utter these words, and not just these words, but embrace this kind of mindset. I want you to think about it. And the person he seems to be addressing here in verse 13 is a merchant or a businessman. And this was a very common profession in Bible times, especially among a Jewish audience. They were oftentimes employed as merchants, traveling from city to city, selling some kind of ware, you know, whether it was handmade products or whether it was selling something somebody else had made. A merchant would go around and they would buy and they would trade and they would try and do business. And then whenever business dried up in a certain location, they would pack up all their belongings and their whole business and move on to the next town. And it was a traveling merchant. And this was a very common thing. And the merchant had to be a planner. You have to make some kind of plans in order to carry on this kind of business. But the issue that James identifies here is not that he's planning, but that he's planning quite without God in the picture. In his mind, he's created a superb business plan. He's lined up everything. It's ready to fly. The problem is not in what he says, but in what he leaves out. And by the way, that can often be the case with our own plans. Our failures come not from what we say or what we do, but what we leave out. And what has the man left out here? Today, tomorrow, we go into such and such towns, spend a year there, trade, and make a profit. He's left out God from the equation. Because he doesn't know whether this plan is going to come to pass. He is, as some have observed in this passage, a practical atheist. He may believe in God, but his plans certainly don't reflect that belief. But notice what he plans out here in verse 13. And Homer Kent, in his commentary on James, he breaks down this planner helpfully. Here's what he says. The person in James 4:13 makes travel plans, first of all. Today or tomorrow, referring to a day of departure. So in other words, I've got it circled on my calendar, what day this is all going to happen. He specifies his travel plans, then his exact location. I'm going to travel to such and such a town. You know, fill in the blank, wherever it might be. He's got a calendar on one hand and a map on the other, and he pins exactly where he intends to go. He also determines the total duration. I'm going to go, and I'm going to spend a year there. Not a day more, not a day less. Then he decides his precise activity. I'm going to buy and I'm going to sell. Which again, that was just standard practice for a merchant. But he's also, you notice this in verse 13? He also specifies the anticipated outcome. I'm going to buy and sell and I'm going to make a profit. I figured it all out. I've got it all mapped, ready to go. And on paper, it's not a bad plan. He's probably done his research. He's probably chosen a city that he thinks will do very well. But there's an air of arrogance about this whole statement. Just look at the future tense that he uses here. Today or tomorrow, I will, or we will, go into such and such a town. We will buy and trade. We will make a profit. So it seems this person has not even considered the Lord in his plans. It's all about me. What profits me? What benefits me? What pleases me? And he doesn't feel a need to consult anyone else on this plan. He certainly doesn't need to pray about it. Well, the fact is, none of the merchant's plans here in verse 13 are inherently wrong in and of themselves. But such plans are always subject to change. Because why? We are not in charge. You are not in charge. God is. So we see the attitude of the arrogant. Secondly, we see the foolishness of presumption. So here's this grandiose statement. Tomorrow, today, I'm going to do all these things and I'm going to make a profit. And then James says, verse 14, yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. Yeah, he's got his plan laid out for the next year, but in reality, he has no idea what's going to happen even the next day. And frankly, none of us do. Here in the verse, you don't know if you're going to even be alive next day. Now, I have no doubt in my mind that James is thinking of Proverbs 27, verse 1 here. Proverbs 27:1 says, do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth. Perhaps James is even thinking of Jesus' own parable that he told about a rich man who piled up his wealth, and he built barns, and then he tore those down and built bigger barns in order to keep all of his stuff, and he planned a happy retirement, but the Lord said to him in Luke 12:20, fool, fool, this night your soul will be required of you, then whose will all these things be? So the attitude of the arrogant manifests in this foolish presumption to think, I can plan for the future when you have no idea. There are plenty of examples of this where people thought they had tomorrow and they could bank on what was to come. Back in 2007 and 2008, many people were making plans. They were investing vast sums of money into the housing market. And prices in the housing market were pretty attractive in 2007, 2008. People were taking loans which were, frankly, extreme risks for the banks. In July of 2008, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said, our banking system is a safe and a sound one. That was 2008. And then the bubble burst, and it was the biggest financial disaster since 1929. Everyone who had so confidently invested money lost a lot of it. Again, you don't know what tomorrow is going to hold. I'm sure all those banks were thinking, we've got a 10-year plan that we're working with, only to find out things crashing around them. Someone once said, life is what happens while we're making other plans. While we plan life, life comes quickly at us. don't know if anybody remembers, there used to be these commercials on TV where it said, life comes at you fast. I think it was an insurance company. And it would always, you know, things just accelerated in people's lives. Life comes at you fast. Well, that's kind of what James is saying here. You've got a plan, and I know you think you're in charge, but you're not. Life comes at you fast, and things change rather rapidly. Here's the question. Do we submit ourselves to God's plan, or do we hold fast to our own? Do we sound like the merchant of verse 13? I hope not. I hope nobody here is guilty of that kind of presumption. Yet sometimes we cling tightly to our own plans. And one of the ways we can see whether or not we're submitting to God's plan for our life rather than holding fast to our own is, how do we react when our plans get turned upside down? How do we respond when our plans get completely thrown out the window? My guess is sometimes we get pretty upset, pretty angry, pretty depressed when our plans don't work out. I remember one day 13 years ago, I was planning the day on which I was going to ask Ashley to marry me. And I had a plan for it. We were going to go to such and such a place, and we were going to, you know, I was going to propose to her right on this rock outcropping right in front of this beautiful grist mill. So I had a whole plan for it. And the plan did happen, but there were a lot of hiccups along the way. And Ashley can probably tell you this. The morning of, we had a lot of rain that came through. And, you know, this was an all-outdoor proposal. So I was very keyed up and very upset that what seemed like my plan was falling apart. And, of course, she didn't know I was going to ask her that day. So she's thinking, you know, why are you so upset about all this? What's the big deal? We can always do something else. And I'm very keyed up because I had a plan. And God's not following my plan. Is that how you feel? I'm in charge. And when God disrupts my plan a little bit, ooh, I get real prickly. Maybe that's us trying to think we're in charge. Maybe that's us acting like this arrogant merchant. So the first reminder, you're not in charge. Second reminder for all of us from this passage is your life is fragile. Your life is fragile. This is the perfect illustration of what James is trying to say. You can't count on tomorrow because you may not even be here tomorrow. You'll see this in verse 14. It says, you don't know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? Now, that little phrase there, what is your life, some people connect it back to the earlier statements, basically saying, you don't know what tomorrow will bring into your life, something like that. But I think it's better here as a question. What is your life? In other words, not what's the quality of your life, it's rather, what is your life compared to? What's our life like? He says, it's like a mist. It's like a vapor. It's like something that's here one moment and gone the next. Life is unstable. You know, we may not live to make all of the appointments marked down in our planners. That's not me being pessimistic. That's just being realistic about the brevity of life. Life will soon be over. And no one knows when that's going to happen. So he says, what is your life? What's it like? It's like a vapor. I think of this. You know, sometimes we'll have a cool morning and it'll be real foggy out. And that lasts for a little bit, but as soon as the sun comes up, the fog dissipates and it disappears. Or maybe a better illustration would be the vapor that comes out of your own mouth on a cold day. You walk outside, it's cold, and you breathe, and you can see your breath for about a second, and then it's gone. It vanishes. That's what James says. He says, your life is like that. It's here one moment, gone the next. Bible, by the way, uses a number of metaphors for the brevity of life. Back in James chapter 1, verse 10, it says, our life is like a grass. It withers and fades away. The Bible in Psalm 102, verse 3, compares our existence on earth to smoke. Or here, a vapor. Listen to this. This is from Psalm 90. It says in Psalm 90, the days of our lives are 70 years, or if by reason of strength they are 80. Yet their boast is only labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off and we fly away. In other words, if you live to be 70, 80, maybe 90 years old, yeah, we've lived a full life, but it's still a vapor. It's still just a blip on the map in terms of eternity. You know, current life expectancy in America is 79 years old. I figured it up. If I make it to the average, I have about 42 years left, about 504 months, about 2,800 or 184 weeks left in my life. But the fact is, I don't even know if I'm going to make it to the average or even close. That's why the psalmist says in Psalm 90, verse 2, teach us to number our days. Teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. I know this is kind of a sad and morbid topic to talk about, but our lives are fragile. No one knows how long theirs will last. The arrogant businessman who's making all of his plans for year after year after year, all the way up to retirement, he doesn't know if he's going to live to see that retirement. And yet he's so confident in his assertion. The arrogant person presumes that there will be tomorrows in which to use. But we don't know that. It's not a guarantee. Here's a great illustration of that. In 1969, Bruce Lee was an upcoming figure. Bruce Lee, of course, martial artist. He probably did more than anyone to bring martial arts to kind of the Western world and to people's consciousness. But Bruce Lee, you know, was an amazing athlete and made a lot of films where he was, you know, fighting people and this sort of thing. But in 1969, his star was starting to rise, but he wasn't there yet. He wasn't a superstar. And he wrote himself a letter. It was one of these kind of motivational pieces where you write yourself a letter saying, here's what I want to do and here's what I want to be. Well, he did one for himself, and here's what it says. I, Bruce Lee, will be the highest paid Oriental superstar in the United States. In return, I will give the most exciting performances and render the best quality as an actor. Starting in 1970, I will achieve world fame. And from then onward, till 1980, I will have in my possession $10 million. I will live the way I please and achieve inner harmony and happiness. Signed, Bruce Lee, January 1969. Wow, talk about somebody with a plan. Talk about somebody with some ambition and some vision, right? Bruce Lee would go on to achieve worldwide fame. But as far as by 1980 making $10 million, well, Bruce Lee died in 1973, 4 years after writing this note. And his death is still kind of a mystery as to what the cause was. But here's somebody who knows, here's what I'm going to do, and here's what I'm going to do the year after that, and here's how much money I'm going to make by the time 1980 rolls around. Well, he's not even going to live to see 1980. That's the attitude of the arrogant, presumptuous planner. James says, you don't know what tomorrow holds, for what is your life? It appears for a little time and then vanishes. Have you come to reckon with this reality in your own life? You don't know how long you have. I don't either. I think as Christians, we're really best served by recognizing this truth. My life is fragile. I don't have tomorrow. In fact, I don't even know if I have the rest of the day. I may not even make it home today. Again, that's not just being morbid, but just being real. Are we ready to face our Creator? Are we ready to stand before the judgment seat? Do you know for a fact that Jesus has died for your sins and that you are covered by his precious blood? Have you trusted in the only hope there is for mankind? Because you don't know. There may not be a tomorrow. There might not be another chance to receive that good news. I'm struck by the story of a former Cincinnati Reds pitcher and a radio host named Frank Pastore. He played for the Reds back in the 70s, but he became a Christian in his adult years and went on to start a Christian radio station and radio program in California. And in 2012, he was on the radio talking about the Christian perspective of death and of immortality. And in that radio broadcast, he said, "You guys know that I ride a motorcycle, don't you? And any minute, I could be spread all over the 210, which is a highway in California. And then he went on to say, but that's not the end for me. I've trusted in Jesus. My soul is secure in him. Well, that was November 19th, 2012. That afternoon, he got on his motorcycle to go home, and he was struck on Highway 210. About a month later, he died from his injuries. And a lot of the secular media all said, they took the story as he predicted his own death. It wasn't a prediction. He was just being honest. My life could end any moment. I'm ready for it. Are you? Are you ready for your life to end? This planner wasn't. He was busy planning out his future in the next 10 years, but gave no thought to his own soul. Let us not do that. May we plan and prepare for the future, but also be ready for death when it comes. I'm not trying to sell a grave plot or an insurance policy, but I want you to be ready for eternity. And when your eyes close in death and you meet your Creator, it is those who have believed in Christ who will have hope and who will enter into that glorious presence of their best friend. What is your life? It's just a vapor. Our life is fragile. Third reminder that we should take from this text. Not only are we not in charge, not only is our life fragile, but third, your arrogance is wrong. Your arrogance is wrong. The attitude we've described here in this passage is one of arrogance and self-sufficiency. It's the person who feels confident in themselves, in their own future. They don't look to the Lord for their plans. They don't involve the Lord in their plans. But I think even secular people would probably say, yes, it's foolish to presume upon tomorrow. But the Bible goes further than that. It says, if you arrogantly boast about the future, you sin. Look at this, verse 15. It says, instead you ought to say, that is, instead of this attitude we've just looked at, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is what? It's evil. It's not foolish. It's not just misguided. It's evil. It's sinful. So verse 15 provides us, first of all, the proper attitude toward the future. What should our attitude? If it's not to be that of the arrogant, presumptuous planner, what is it to be? Well, he says in verse 15, instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. I found this interesting. In the beginning of verse 15, it says, instead. It's the Greek word anti, which anti means against or opposed to. So he's saying the anti-attitude of the presumptuous planner, of the arrogant person, the opposite of that is the one who says, if the Lord wills. See, tomorrow is not a given. Our plans are subject to the sovereignty of God. So we ought to say, if the Lord wills. Now, when James was writing this, pagans sometimes spoke that way. They would say things like, if the gods permit, or if the fates align, we will do this and that or the other. That's not what James is talking about here. He's simply saying that all our plans ought to be submitted, first of all, to the Lord. This isn't just lip service. This isn't just a phrase that we should just glibly adopt as if, God wants me every time I make the plan to say, if the Lord wills. Now, you'll hear me saying that sometimes. I'll say things like, I'll see you Saturday, Lord willing. But hopefully that's not just a throwaway phrase. Hopefully that's not just some irrelevant, added statement that means nothing. Hopefully it's a true expression of the heart. Here's what Doug Moo, a conservative commentator, writes. He says, what James encourages is not the constant verbalization of a formula, if the Lord wills, which can easily become glib and meaningless, but a sincere appreciation for God's control of affairs and his specific will for us. So I don't really care whether or not you say the words Lord willing every time you speak, but that should be what's in your heart. I'm going to make my plans, but you know what? The Lord may have other plans in mind, and I'm ready to go with whatever he wills. So do we hold our plans with an open hand? Do we realize that God could change them dramatically? So the proper attitudes towards the future is one that says, Lord willing. Secondly, though, we also notice the pure sinfulness of arrogance. Verse 16. As it is, in other words, instead of doing the thing you should do, you boast. And he says, all such boasting is evil. He's boastful and arrogant because his future, he acts as if he's in control of everything, that he's in charge. The word translated arrogant here in verse 16, as it is, you boast in your arrogance. It's kind of an interesting word. It's not the usual word for boasting. It's not the usual word the New Testament uses for arrogance. It's only used twice in the New Testament, as I recall. And it was a word which was applied to a traveling quack. You may not see this so much because I think most quacks travel online these days. But like if you watch old TV or old movies like Little House on the Prairie, there's always some traveling salesman, some, you know, Dr. Brown's Miracle Tonic that rolls into town in the big wagon, and they're selling bottles of it. Buy this and it'll cure your rheumatism and your arthritis and whatever else ails you. Dr. Brown's Tonic. Well, that happened in ancient times too, during the Bible days. You know, there were people who came along peddling miracle cures, and it was just sugar water or just some harmless thing. And yet it came with great promises. I think what James is saying, he's like, that's what you sound like whenever you talk like this. When you say, today or tomorrow, I'm going to do this and that, you sound like one of these people who's just talking a big game, but there's nothing to back it up. Because you can't control your life. You can't, you know, make it stop raining. You can't change the course of events. He says, you sound like this Dr. Brown selling his tonic from the back of a wagon with all the gusto and all the confidence, yet you don't have control of anything. What a foolish and stupid thought it is to think that we could determine future events. Such boasting is not just foolish, it's sinful. He says, all such boasting in verse 16 is evil. You might say, well, I know boasting is probably not what I should do, but is it really evil? I mean, whenever I think of things that are evil, I think of violence and all kinds of horrible crimes. Is this a horrible crime? Again, James is trying to help us see that these attitudes are far more serious than we often give them credit for. In fact, the attitude of human boasting is the sin of Genesis 11. Do you remember the story of the Tower of Babel? All mankind gathers together to build a tower up to heaven, and it's the ultimate expression of human arrogance. Listen to this. This is from Genesis 11, verse 4. Here's what the people said. Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is to the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered over the face of the whole earth. When I read that verse, does that sound familiar? Does it sound a little bit like, today or tomorrow I'm going to buy and sell and travel and make a profit? It's the same kind of attitude. The thing which God so detested at Babel is the same kind of attitude that we can sometimes embrace. Such boasting is evil. Finally, though, we see the pure sinfulness of arrogance. Third, we find the principle of full obedience. So verse 17 is kind of a principle, a broad principle that applies in a number of different contexts, but it applies here as well. It says this, so whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. The broad principle is if we know to do something good and we don't do it, it's the same as doing something wrong. So we call these sins of omission rather than commission. We omit doing something. Well, for James' audience, he's saying, listen, I've told you how to live, and yet to leave God out of the picture is sinful because you know better than that. Now, the sinful world, they make plans all the time. God is never part of their equation. But for those who are in Christ Jesus, who should know better, for us to continue to boastfully plan tomorrow out, it's sin. Because we know better. We know the right to do, and yet when we don't do it, we transgress. To know there is a God and yet to act as if he is not there is a sin. So, do not boast in the future. Submit all your plans to the Lord. Because remember, it's not you who are in charge. You don't even know if you're going to live to see tomorrow. It is only because God wills that we are even alive. So put away all such boasting. You know, we sometimes plan for the future. And again, I know some of you are probably planning the next few months ahead. When you do so, just remember, God may have very different plans in mind for you. And that's good. Embrace that. Don't fight against it. So let me make two practical applications kind of in closing here as we wrap this up. If we're to not boast in the future, and if we are to submit our plans to the Lord, what does that look like? What can we do? Well, I would say this. Number one, let everything you do be permeated by an awareness of God's sovereignty. So no matter what you're doing or what plans you're making, there's always sort of this understanding which undergirds all that we do that, you know what? God's in charge. I make my plans. I try to be wise about them. But ultimately, God is guiding my future. So let everything you do be permeated by this awareness of God's sovereignty. And then I would also say this. Live each day with the awareness that it could be your last. Live each day with an awareness that it could be your last. And I think that's a very profound truth that has the potential to change your life. Are we really living as if today could be our last day? That's a question I sometimes think about. What would I do today if I knew this was my only opportunity? I mean, I don't know that should be a thought that is, you know, every moment of every day, but we ought to stop and think occasionally, you know, how am I spending my life? What if today was the last day on earth? Because we don't know. Maybe it is. I think when we have that thought, it really combats this attitude of arrogance. So live your life in such a way that the decisions you make and the plans that you set for yourself, realize this life is short. What really matters? How should I be spending my time? Live each day with an awareness that it could be your last. Let us say with so many others before, Christians throughout the ages, if the Lord wills, I will do such and such. It's an interesting little phenomenon. It goes back to the Puritans, and maybe even before them. A lot of early Christians would sign letters with the letters DV at the end. You might even sometimes see an old-time letter, and there'll be under the signature or near the signature this abbreviation, DV. It stands for Deo Volente, God willing. The idea of that statement was simply to say, whatever God wills, that's what I want.